China is cracking down on Hong Kong protesters, but today's wave of arrests could backfire.
So if the government's plan is to cut off the heads of these protests, then this is an extremely bad way to do it.
I'm Carol Hills. A Russian national park in the Arctic wants to attract more tourists. It takes 3 days to get there, though. And then there's this.
The main goal for the Russian Arctic National Park rangers is to protect tourists from polar bears.
And a new way to go meat-free.
It appeals to me because I'm a vegan. I have to wrestle with the fact that I have to literally kill animals to feed my dog.
Insect protein for Fido. It's a dog-eat-bug world. We've got those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us. There's an important anniversary coming up for the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong. Saturday is 5 years since the Chinese government decided against fully democratic elections in the territory. Today, authorities in Hong Kong arrested dozens of pro-democracy activists, among them Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow. Here's Chow speaking after she was released on bail.
We can see very clearly that the regime and the Hong Kong government is trying to create a white terror to try to scare Hong Kong people to not to participate in the social movement and in the democratic movement in the future. But we Hong Kong people won't give up and won't be scared by these white terror and injustice.
The Hong Kong government has denied permission for another large protest tomorrow. Wilson Leung is a Hong Kong attorney and founder of the Progressive Lawyers Group. He doubts that arresting a few prominent activists is going to do much.
I think that's quite doubtful because the protests now are quite leaderless in the sense that they don't depend on any prominent figures. They're not led by any well-known organizations. So if the government's plan is to cut off the heads of these protests, then this is an extremely bad way to do it.
Give us a sense of who Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow are in relation to these protests.
Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow, they were two of the prominent leaders in the 2014 protests, the Umbrella Movement, and they really came to prominence as leading figures in that protest. And both of them have been active in the pro-democracy camp since. But in the current protests, there actually have not been any leading figures or, leading organizations who are at the forefront. You know, a lot of it is leaderless, done in small groups, done on forums and messaging apps. So they're inspirational or spiritual kind of figures. They're there and they're definitely well known. But organizationally, they're definitely not, in any sense, the leader of the current protests.
What were Joshua Wong and Agnes Chow charged with?
They were charged with inciting and organizing an unauthorized protest. This was a protest around 2 months ago when protesters surrounded the police headquarters, and they have to report back to court on November 8th. It's likely that that's going to be a procedural hearing only, and the actual trial, if any, will take place, probably at least a year from now.
A lot of these protests, these recent protests, started over the proposed extradition law that Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam tried to introduce. And there are now reports that she actually tried to withdraw this extradition bill in the midst of these protests several weeks ago, and that Beijing rejected her request. Does that news change anything for the protesters out there?
So in terms of the protesters' motivation or calculus, I don't think it changes much. What it does do, though, is actually confirm, the belief that this extradition bill was a very dangerous proposal in the first place, because Carrie Lam argued that she would act as an effective gatekeeper behind any extradition request coming from Beijing. But the latest news, saying that she can't even withdraw a bill without their approval, I think puts a lot of doubt on that initial denial.
The unrest that has rocked Hong Kong, these protests, they've lasted weeks now. How long can this continue? I mean, what's next in your mind?
Obviously, a lot of it is quite fluid, and no one, I don't think anyone on either side could have predicted that they lasted as long as they did. So it's a bit of guesswork how long they will last. But at the moment, it doesn't seem like the momentum is dropping. And the longer it lasts, the more things occur that outrage the protesters, such as more and more instances of brutality. And now we get, these mass arrests. So, at the moment, it doesn't seem like the momentum is dropping.
Wilson Leung is a lawyer and founder of the Progressive Lawyers Group in Hong Kong. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
Ever since the large-scale Hong Kong protests began in June, this question keeps coming up. Will Beijing send in the troops? Nothing like that has happened yet, but the Chinese government is most certainly working to thwart this protest movement. One way it's doing that is by putting pressure on companies to penalize employees who participate. Hong Kong's flagship airline, Cathay Pacific, is one of those companies. More than a dozen people say they were let go this month for their involvement in the protest movement.
Of course, the workers are shocked and they're very scared.
Carol Ning is the chairwoman of the Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions. It's working with some of the unionized employees who were fired. She says the dismissals started when China's aviation authority got word that Cathay employees were out protesting, and then it issued new rules targeting the company.
They require Cathay Pacific to cease any personnel to fly into or above China if they were participating in any illegal protests. The second rule is they need to submit a list of the cabin crew and pilots before any particular flights operate. Usually the airlines submit these lists about 2 hours before the flight departure, but now they require them to submit this list 1 day beforehand.
So that second one, in terms of submitting names of employees who will be on these flights, the day before as opposed to a few hours, is that presumably so the CAAC can look into who these people are and whether they've been participating in the protests?
I presume yes.
Do you know whether any Cathay Pacific employees have been fired over things that they've posted on their social media accounts?
Yes, they did. Most of the employees tell us is they will be shown 2 to 3 pictures from their personal Facebook accounts. And the managers in front of them will ask them to identify it and just answer yes or no. Is this from your own Facebook? And then once they say yes and yes for 2 different pictures, then immediately the managers say, okay, according to company procedures, we are now firing you.
Now, to your knowledge, when employees are being let go, are they explicitly being told it was because of their participation in the protests?
No, none of the cases getting a reason. They simply told by the company that we cannot tell you the reason.
Cathay is a private company and it's at the mercy of the regulators where it operates, China included. So it wants to be on good terms with the government there. What about the argument that the company has to make decisions that are good for business?
This is how they're saying it, and they're still saying that they are following the local laws in order to fire people. But if you get terminated, you need to be initiated a disciplinary procedures. But there isn't any case showing there was any disciplinary taking place. So it's obviously the company just simply flick the fingers and tell people, I'm firing you now.
But are any of the employees that you know of challenging it?
All of them are ready to challenge it legally, and we will start to file the case as soon as possible.
Are you hearing from people in other industries who are feeling the same pressures as Cathay employees?
Oh, yes, yes. There's loads of our different affiliates come back to tell us. First of all, it's the civil servants, those working in the government. They're asking anyone who was participating in the last general strike, it was 5th of August, the department head, you need to report how many people were absent. And also some accounting company, they're also asking people, anyone was absent on the last general strike, need to submit the numbers of each department or the name list or who was participating in it. So quite a lot of the pressure in different industries from their bosses.
Carol Ning is the chairwoman of the Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Far, far north, inside the Arctic Circle, there's a cluster of icy islands, an archipelago. Franz Josef Land, it's called. The place is only 560 miles away from the North Pole. But people do travel there. The journey from Russia's northern coast takes 3 days by sea. And this week, they opened a new tourist center on Hooker Island. It's part of Franz Josef Land. Russian officials want to attract more tourists to the Arctic region. And today, the very first cruise ship arrived on Hooker Island for a visit. Alexandra Kabanikina is with the Russian Arctic National Park. She joins us from Arkhangelsk, or Archangel, in northern Russia. Alexandra, so if you land on Hooker Island, you get off your ship that brought you there, can you just wander around or do you need a guide?
You can just walk around by yourself, but not everywhere, because we try not to affect the vulnerable ecosystem in the Arctic. So for this reason, our employees, they created a whole network of ecological paths along which tourists walk around.
Are there many polar bears? I mean, we're talking about the Arctic.
Well, the main goal for the Russian Arctic National Park rangers is to protect tourists from polar bears. Mm. Of course, if there is a polar bear, there will be no landing. Tourists won't be able to go ashore. They will stay on the board of the vessel.
So the guides keep an eye out for polar bears and make sure that the tourists don't encounter one.
Yeah, okay. That's right.
So it's late August. What's the weather like right now on Hooker Island?
Well, the weather can change any moment. Now I guess it's about 2 degrees above zero. It's not too windy. The sun is not shining, but the weather is fine. The summer in the Arctic, it's not the common summer that we can imagine. There's still snow, but you can also see flowers, green mosses. So it's different.
Has climate change or perhaps better technology made it easier for people to travel to these remote areas in the Arctic?
I would say better technologies, but anyway, while approaching to the North Pole, the sea ice can be so thick that the vessel will have to go back and find a new way. So we must always remember that we are guests in the Arctic and it can be very unfriendly.
You're involved in the education side of the Russian Arctic National Park. What are you trying to teach the public about the Arctic today?
Our main goal is to share the information about the uniqueness of our territories, because Franz Josef Land is a unique territory. It differs because of its remoteness, its severe climate. Because tourists come to the Arctic trying to escape the everyday stress, and they can find amazing animals and birds that can be found only here. Polar bears, of course. Also walruses, bowhead whales, seals, Arctic fox, narwhals. It's the symbol of our park, a narwhal. It is also called the unicorn of the sea. Tourists can just listen to the sounds, how the icebreaker cracks the ice. It's really amazing.
For you personally, Alexandra, what's your interest in the Arctic? I mean, did you grow up in a northern climate? And where does your passion for this subject come from?
I was born in Archangel, and I have lived here for the whole life. And my personal interest in the Arctic is that I'm really proud of that territory. Every time I see photos, videos, it makes me really happy that we were able to preserve the uniqueness of this territory. I will try to do my best just to let people know that this territory exists and we must preserve it.
Alexandra Kabanikina is the head of the Environmental Education and Tourism Department for the Russian Arctic National Park. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
Thank you.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In the UK, one of the fastest growing demographics in the workforce is women over 50. and that includes women going through menopause. But there's a stigma attached to talking about menopause at the office. Now, some members of parliament want to change that. They're introducing a proposal to create workplace protections for women going through menopause. Deborah Garlick is the founder of Henpicked, a website for women over 40 in the UK. She's been working with companies on policies to accommodate employees experiencing symptoms of menopause.
The symptoms that women tell us affect them most at work are more on the psychological side. Insomnia, difficulty sleeping, of course, fatigue, anxiety and worry, problems with recall, with hot flushes coming in there, but primarily the psychological symptoms.
What kind of policies should, in your view, be put in place by employers to make their workplaces more friendly to women going through menopause?
Talking to one of the police forces, one of the policies that they have in place, or reasonable adjustments as we call them, is the police officer could have a later shift during that day. So they could look at shift patterns. If you're a woman's having problems with temperature control, she may be issued with a desk fan or a mobile fan to enable her to cool down. Actually looking at uniforms and checking to see that they're menopause friendly. Are they made of the right fabric? Are they cut in the right way? Can you give menopausal women an extra garment if they need it so that they can have more changes during the day or the week?
What are the consequences of workplaces not making these adjustments? Because I think it's fair to assume most workplaces don't.
Significant research says that one in four women considers leaving work as a result of their experience. And in the UK, you mentioned at the beginning that menopausal women are the fastest growing workforce demographic. Organisations can't afford to lose talent. It's very difficult to replace talent when it's a shrinking talent pool, when you're an ageing population.
Deborah Garlick is the head of menopause in the workplace and founder of the women's website Henpicked. She's been speaking to us from Nottingham, England. Thanks a lot, Deborah.
Thank you.
In Indian-controlled Kashmir, unprecedented restrictions on freedoms have been in place now for 26 days. Since the government of India unilaterally withdrew the region's semi-autonomous status, authorities have arrested as many as 3,000 people. That includes high-profile politicians, lawyers, journalists, and protesters. India claims its actions are preemptive and designed to maintain law and order in India's only Muslim-majority state. With a near-communications blackout and a ban on all non-Indian journalists entering Kashmir, information about what has been happening on the ground has been slow to emerge. The BBC's Samir Hashmi has been inside Kashmir and brings us this story of night raids and brutal beatings.
Friday prayers at the local mosque. Despite a heavy security clampdown, several Muslims in this village have assembled here. We are in South Kashmir to investigate disturbing allegations of beatings and torture. I've come to a village which is 30 minutes away from the main city of Indian administered Kashmir, Srinagar. I'm going to meet two brothers and they have something to tell me.
Assalamu alaikum, mera naam Samir.
Wa alaikum salam Samir bhai.
As I walk into the house, they invite me to their living room. Like all the people we spoke to, they are too scared to reveal their identities. They tell me, on the first day of the crackdown, soldiers came banging on their door. They were pulled out of their beds and asked for names of people who throw stones on the security forces. A regular occurrence in Kashmir. Both were allegedly hit with rods and cables for 2 hours. They showed us their injuries.
We were asking them, what have we done? You can ask the villagers. They beat every part of my body. When we fainted, they gave us shocks to bring us back to consciousness. They put mud in our mouths. They said, do not scream, do not scream. Why are you screaming? They did not give us any reason. I told them, do not beat us, just shoot us. I was asking God to take me because the torture was unbearable.
In the same neighborhood, I meet another man who was allegedly tortured on the same night. Still in shock, he shows me pictures of bruises on his leg. He believes he was targeted because he's a Muslim.
They pulled my beard so hard, I felt like my teeth would come out. Then when I became unconscious, one of the boys told me that they tried to burn my beard. But then someone in the army stopped him.
We are told that 13 men from this village were allegedly tortured that night.
These incidents were happening, you know, previously as well, but the frequency of these events have increased drastically since.
We spoke to a group of young men who believe the alleged excesses by the security forces will deepen further the mistrust between the locals and the Indian state.
It's only to create fear among the people, nothing else. And if they start beating the people like the way they are doing right now, I think it will lead more alienation, because if we see the history, people who have been beaten by the army, they later on pick up the guns.
We put these claims to the army, who responded with a written statement. The allegations are baseless and unsubstantiated. The Indian army has not manhandled any civilians as alleged. Security forces operate strictly to ensure safety and security of civilians. The Indian Army is a professional organization that understands and respects human rights. Kashmir has been mired in conflict for decades. It's one of the most militarized zones in the world. Many Kashmiris want independence, and since 1989, there has been an insurgency against the Indian state. In many parts of this region, there is huge sympathy for the militant groups who are seen as freedom fighters. I've come to a cemetery here in a village called Karimabad. And at the cemetery, there are 16 people that are buried, and all of them died fighting the Indian military. The whole cemetery is covered with colorful garlands, and there's also a sign on the wall which says Freedom Fighters of Karimabad. A few kilometers away, I meet a man who has a broken leg. He says his brother is a member of a banned militant group. The soldiers allegedly wanted information from him about his brother, who visits the family sometimes.
I held both my hands out and they tied them, and my legs as well. They hung me upside down. They beat me a lot for about 2 to 2.5 hours.
For weeks now, there have been clashes between protesters and security forces in some neighborhoods. Locals throw stones on the security forces. Troops fire tear gas and lead pellets. There is a backlash against the government's decision to revoke the region's semi-autonomous status. But many people across the rest of India have welcomed the decision and praised Prime Minister Modi for the bold move. The government says they are gradually lifting some of the restrictions in Kashmir, but internet and mobile phones remain shut down. Kashmir has been virtually cut off from the rest of the world for almost a month now, and anger is growing.
The BBC's Samir Hashmi reporting from Kashmir. This is The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
It's been only 3 years since Colombia reached a peace deal with the FARC rebels. Now it's in danger of falling apart.
There's a great sense of grief from people who really believed in peace, in the peace process in Colombia.
And hurricane warnings come in many languages. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, PRI, and PRX. People on the island of Puerto Rico are breathing easier today. The eye of Hurricane Dorian passed them by. But it's now making its way to Florida, where people are nervously prepping for what's to come. The U.S. National Hurricane Center upgraded Dorian to a Category 3 storm this afternoon and described it as an extremely dangerous major hurricane. During the last big hurricane, Irma, fears of ID checks at Florida shelters led some immigrants to be reluctant to seek help. Storms are ripe for misinformation, too. Paula Munoz is working to counter all of that in a very old-fashioned way, a phone hotline.
Gracias por llamar a la línea directa de la Coalición de Inmigrantes de la Florida.
Thank you for calling the Florida Immigrant Coalition hotline. You will now be...
Merci d'avoir appelé la Hotline Florida Immigrant Coalition.
In our organization, we're giving information in Spanish, English, and Creole, which is a lot of the communities that are in Florida that are specifically also in South Florida and our areas.
Munoz is with the Florida Immigrant Coalition in Miami. The group's general hotline is kicking into high gear as Dorian approaches the Florida coast.
Our main message is for them to know that they have rights and that they're able to still acquire resources and safety. You know, there's a lot of misinformation that goes out there and a lot of fear, which is very valid due to the current environment. So we definitely want to make sure that folks know that, you know, if their homes are not safe for this type of hurricane, that, you know, there's places that they could go. They're still allowed to go to shelters. They shouldn't be asked for IDs. And just making sure that, you know, they're also preparing in the best way for this storm.
What kind of calls are you getting on the hotline from immigrants?
It's always, you know, the fear, right? Like, where are places that are safe for us to go to, right? Without being harassed by authorities, without being harassed about their status. It's very warranted in this state and in the environment that we have. And so making sure that they do have refuge during this moment, that they're connected to resources, and also in different languages as well.
What's the kind of misinformation that you're trying to correct when you talk to immigrants who call in?
You know, in the past, when we had Irma, there was a sheriff that said that ICE would be in the shelters and that they would be asking for information. So that's something that we're trying to counter because it affects a lot of communities. You know, it could be the difference between someone getting really harmed by the storm. And so that's something we're countering and making sure that, you know, we are getting any reports if there are any sites of ICE in the shelters, which there should not be. ICE actually mentioned in our article this morning that they're not going to be operating during the hurricane, but we're also making sure that we're prepared so people can report these things.
What was your experience during Hurricane Irma? I mean, what were you concerned about?
So during Hurricane Irma, a lot of the things that we were concerned about was definitely like the food deserts, right? Like the communities that don't have a lot of resources and who are particularly mostly like, you know, like a lot of them are immigrant communities where, you know, there were people that were not coming out to seek aid or they weren't knowledgeable of like the different resources and access to information. So that was a huge concern, which is why we did a lot of door knockings. And a lot of us, like, you know, we were paying from our own pocket, like buying the food on the ground. And so like this time around, we're trying to be more prepared.
Paula Munoz is an organizer with the Florida Immigrant Coalition in Miami. Thanks a lot, Paula.
Thank you so much.
Another person who's getting ready for the hurricane is Nancy Mateer with the New Florida Majority. She's in Fort Lauderdale helping to staff a volunteer center.
Hello.
Hi, Nancy. It's Carol Hills in Boston.
Hi, how are you?
So Nancy, how's it going? What are you up to?
Well, we are getting ready and making sure that our folk feel safe and prepared for this hurricane. Right now, we're at the Community Emergency Operations Center, ensuring that we're ready, stocked up.
Describe for us what it's like. Visualize where you are and what's going on.
Right now, we are getting ready, setting up. We have a few volunteers, folks here standing in line, trying to get some information from us.
And what does your center look like? Describe it for us.
It's an old museum. It's a historical museum. It's called the Old Dillard Museum. You were fortunate enough to partner with this organization to give us some space to provide some storage and also serve as a community hub after the storm.
Are there immigrants at your center and are they concerned at all about how they might access resources and get help?
Some are. Some are very worried. Some don't tell us that they're immigrants. They prefer not to because they don't want to be targeted. You know, I'm of Haitian descent, so folks who come up to me and speak Haitian Creole, I'm able to have a conversation with them. And some people are just scared. They don't want to tell you their status because they don't want to be faced with the fear of being deported.
So your center, it's an all-volunteer operation, isn't it?
Yes, it's a grassroots-led initiative. It was actually sparked after Hurricane Irma, where government really didn't show up for our most vulnerable communities. So what happened was community members stepped up, we came together and we said, hey, we're no longer waiting for government and we're going to step in, because we strongly believe that our neighbors are our first responders.
How many volunteers do you have?
At the moment, we have between 10 to 15 at the center right now. But after Hurricane Irma, we had roughly 500 people assist, and that was throughout the state of Florida.
Nancy Mater speaking to us from Fort Lauderdale, where she's preparing to help immigrants and other vulnerable groups in the community. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Late last week, 17-year-old Ismail Ajawi from Lebanon flew into Logan Airport here in Boston. He came to study at Harvard, but he didn't make it to classes. Delano Franklin from the Harvard Crimson student newspaper told the BBC what happened to Ajawi.
After, you know, normal passport checks and a round of questioning, he says that an immigration officer detained him for around 5 hours and searched through his phone and his laptop and searched through his social media accounts. After that, that same immigration officer told him that they would be canceling his visa and that he would have to be deported.
Ajawi told the Crimson he was sent back to Lebanon because U.S. border officials saw posts by his friends on social media opposing the U.S. So just how far can border officials go when they're questioning people at American ports of entry? Abed Ayoub is the legal and policy director at the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. I asked him whether non-citizens entering the U.S. can refuse to answer certain questions or refuse to give up their phones.
You know, that's the most common scenario, the most common question we get at ADC. Of course, you can refuse, but just know that may lead into you being delayed or held up at the airport and most likely not being admitted into the U.S. This is very problematic, and that's what raises concerns with us.
We've heard more and more reports like the case of the Harvard student where immigration officials are asking questions about people's social media posts. Are they actually allowed to do that?
Yes, they are. And keep in mind that now when you apply for the visa, they ask you questions about your social media accounts and your social media activity. Now they're digging into those accounts. They're going through phones to try to build a profile. Question of, again, whether or not it's allowed to happen, we know it is happening. And absent litigation, absent a rule change, it's going to continue happening. The case of the Harvard student is unique because we heard of it. It reached media and it went viral, so people heard of that case. But every day we're dealing with situations involving travelers, involving non-citizen visa holders coming into the U.S. with a reefer student or medical treatment, who are asked about a picture received or a message received in WhatsApp or a Facebook post or, you know, a retweet. And that is the basis for not admitting them into the U.S.
What are immigration authorities looking for when they comb through people's social media posts?
In short, the officer is looking for information to determine whether or not the person's admissible. Now, if the person is posting about committing a terror attack or causing harm on the U.S. or inflicting harm, they make that determination and say, okay, this person's not allowed to enter. But now we're in a gray area, and what we feel is the Arab and Muslim travelers are held to a different standard. You know, if somebody is posting comments that they dislike Trump or they dislike an American policy, does that make them inadmissible? If somebody posts something that's pro-Palestinian and they have the Palestinian flag, does that make them inadmissible as compared to somebody who posts something about being pro-Israel? The big issue we're seeing is with the WhatsApp messaging service. Personally, I don't consider WhatsApp a social media service. And if anybody has been in a WhatsApp group, you know, things get forwarded, you get added to groups, you don't know who's in there. And sometimes people have auto-download on WhatsApp. So if somebody sends a picture in a WhatsApp group, it gets stored on your phone. So the danger is we're going down into policing thought, policing free speech. And we don't have a clear indication of what CBP is looking for. So they can interpret the information any way each officer sees fit. They're acting under their own volition. They're acting under their own will. And these cases are happening daily. The Harvard incident is not an isolated incident.
Do things change based on where a non-citizen is being questioned? I mean, would you have different advice for someone entering an airport versus a border checkpoint, for example?
Things change under two circumstances. One, these rules on paper apply to everybody, but we're seeing Arab and Muslims held to different standards for admissibility. So the first determination, the first thing that changes, if you're an Arab or a Muslim and you're coming here, you can anticipate a harder, more difficult time from the CBP officer, and your information will be interpreted differently. The second thing is correct. Each point of entry is going to be different. We don't have set guidelines and parameters for these officers. There are some airports that we see more problems out of. Boston Logan has historically shown to have more problems and more issues for our community.
Meaning Logan Airport here in Boston tends to stop more Arabs and Muslims than other airports.
Yes, yes. So it does matter where you're flying into, and it does matter where you're flying from.
Is there one piece of advice that you have for people, for non-citizens who are seeking to enter the U.S. at an airport?
Be truthful on your applications. Be truthful to the officer. Don't be afraid to answer the questions, but don't feel compelled. And as far as your cell phone, clear out WhatsApp, clear out some of the applications before you enter so they're not being scrutinized by the officer. And it's unfortunate we have to say this. We're firm believers in First Amendment right. We're firm believers in people having the ability to speak freely, post on Facebook, and not worry about repercussions at the border. But unfortunately, the way the rules are, you have to take into account that these officers are going to weigh this information. So delete it before coming to the U.S.
Abed Ayoub with the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, which is based in D.C. Thanks a lot, Abed.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
The peace agreement in Colombia that brought an end to more than 50 years of war is now on the line. Yesterday, leaders from the FARC rebels put out a call to arms. And today, the Colombian government said it carried out a military operation in the south of the country that killed 9 dissident FARC rebel fighters. It was only 3 years ago that the FARC signed a peace deal with the government, but that agreement is under threat, along with the country's newfound stability. Maria Emma Wills Obregón is a professor at the University of Los Andes in Colombia. She's also a government researcher and has documented the history of the conflict. Maria Emma, you're in Colombia right now. What does this moment feel like? I mean, what are people in Colombia saying?
I think there's a great sense of grief from people who really believed in peace, in the peace process in Colombia. The situation is quite complex, and the process is facing threats, not only by the members of the guerrilla who said yesterday that they were going back to arms, but also from the government who hasn't been proactive in putting into life the accord that was signed in the last government.
I know you were one of the only women involved in this peace process between FARC and the Colombian government. Did you ever imagine that any FARC leaders were going to renege on this? I mean, did you even think this was possible?
First of all, let me clear my role in the peace negotiations. I was not part of the negotiation team. I was called upon because the FARC and the government decided to have a commission who had to write the history of the conflict in Colombia. So I came as an academic, not as a negotiator, into Havana. Many of the negotiators from the government knew that you always have in these peace agreements dissidents. You always calculate a number of people who go back into war. And according to the numbers and the percentages in Colombia, we are within the norm.
Well, I want to ask you, as somebody who followed the peace process closely, you as an academic conducted research for the process, where do you stand on this? I know there are very strong and really contrasting feelings in Colombia about how to deal with the FARC or former FARC members. I mean, President Iván Duque is a hardliner on this. So where do you stand on this?
First of all, I'm very critical of what Márquez did. I think he took the wrong decision at the wrong time. Peace building is very difficult. Peace processes always face challenges, always. So the decision of the FARC can't be backed up by the argument that the state didn't come up with the right solutions or wasn't involved enough in the peace process. We knew that it was going to be difficult. So I really think that the guerrillas, the commanders of the FARC, are going against many people who went to the streets to defend the accord and to defend peace.
Practically at this point, because of what happened yesterday and Iván Márquez, former FARC leader, renewing a call for arms, is Colombia now back in a state of war at this point?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think that the peace process, I do agree with the statement of the negotiation team from President Santos.
Juan Manuel Santos, the former president of Colombia.
What they said is the peace negotiation is a process that you can't go back to. We do have problems of violence in Colombia, but we're not back in square one. Arms and politics are a combination that do not resonate as it did resonate in the 60s or 70s in Colombia. It doesn't have the resonance that it had before. It doesn't have the legitimacy as it had before.
Maria Emma Wills Obregón is a professor at the University of Los Andes in Colombia. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Popeye's chicken ruffled some feathers this week.
What? No.
We're sold out of chicken sandwiches. We sold out in 4 hours.
Condolences to anybody who didn't get one. But hey, all publicity is good publicity. The incident generated an estimated $23 million in free advertising for Popeyes. That's significant for the fast food chain's rivalry with places like Chick-fil-A. Chick-fil-A claims they created the chicken sandwich as we know it back in the 1940s. Since then, the American delicacy, if you will, has become a global culinary phenomenon. The chicken sandwich sits along others like Italian pasta dishes, Korean kimchi, and the Mexican taco. They're all part of a global market explored in a new study on cuisine trade patterns. How do different cuisines rank in the global food chain? Joel Waldfogel is an economist at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management, and he authored the study. Professor Waldfogel, what prompted you to look into the world's top cuisine exporter? Are you a foodie?
I do like food, like many people, but my interest here stemmed from an interest I have in cultural products generally, mostly movies, books, television, and music. What prompted me to look at cuisine was just it occurred to me that while the usual audiovisual cultural products are the main ones that people talk about and think about, cuisine, if one were to view it as a cultural product, is actually enormous compared to those others.
So what did you find out?
Which cuisines are popular, which is in some sense which cuisines are, quote, exported. And this isn't literally exports. I mean, when a German eats Italian food in Germany, there really isn't an export from Italy to Germany, unless some tomatoes or olive oil got exported. But the popular cuisines by that export measure are Italian and Japanese, Chinese, Mexican, the U.S. actually quite popular as well. But there's a different notion, a notion of the net exports. So Italian food and Japanese food have two characteristics. They're both very popular outside of the home countries, but what's also true is that non-Italian food isn't very popular in Italy, and non-Japanese food isn't very popular in Japan.
Hmm.
So they have cuisines that export well, but they have domestic populations that don't seem to want to import very much.
And what are some countries that are different in that respect?
The United States is a very epicurious country. We have a lot of non-U.S. food available and consumed in the U.S. The same is true for actually most of the Anglophone countries, which don't tend to be known for their cuisines.
I was curious how you defined American cuisine in your study, because so much of American cuisine is really cuisine from various immigrant groups that have come here.
I gave credit to the almost stereotypical origin countries. I'm not going to call tacos American, even though I think they are in some senses American, as is pizza, as is pasta. But I think it's only fair to give those to Mexico and Italy, respectively. And some of what people elsewhere call Italian food, I think Italians wouldn't probably define as Italian food. If there were property rights over this, and I'm not suggesting there should be, but suppose there were royalties required, I do suspect then that the Italians would claim Pizza Hut in a way that they might otherwise not want to claim it as Italian.
And what countries have the least popular cuisine in terms of having it exported or eaten in other countries?
There are certainly some countries that are noted industrial powers that don't seem to export much. So I'm thinking here about countries like Germany.
Some of the countries are countries that 50 years ago were thought to have incredibly bad food, but it's their import or embrace of other cultures' cuisines that have made them now interesting places to eat.
I entirely agree. A country that does a lot of net exporting here has bragging rights, but no additional benefit domestically. Really, the huge beneficiaries here are the consumers in countries who get access to this wealth and variety of foods without having to pay anything but the cost of labor and materials for them.
So what was your methodology? How did you even figure this out?
Ideally, I'd be a fly on the wall in every kitchen or dining room across the world. Instead, I use TripAdvisor data to get the distribution of restaurants across cuisines. And then I use data from a data source called Euromonitor for the volume of spending in restaurants in 52 countries around the world.
So this is not exactly scientific, but what do you think you can conclude from this study?
I think one thing one can conclude is really just about bragging rights. That's just kind of fun. But I think another thing to think about is this general attitude about cultural hegemony. There's a concern about the Anglophone countries in the U.S. that actually prompts a lot of policy in Europe and other places. For example, subsidies to domestic production of movies, quotas for domestic radio airplay of domestic art. But it's not a one-size-fits-all story. If you look across a variety of cultural products, you see different countries being, quote, dominant in different products. And the U.S. is surely, even if a big deal in movies and in software, surely not a big deal in terms of cultural influence in food.
Joel Waldfogel is an economist at the University of Minnesota's Carlson School of Management. His latest paper is called Dining Out as Cultural Trade. Thanks a lot, Joel.
You're very welcome.
When some people decide to get more conscious about what they eat, they go vegetarian. And a big reason why is the environmental impact. But have you considered your dog's diet? It's estimated that up to 20% of the meat produced globally is eaten by pets. Some pet food companies have a solution for that. They're using insect protein instead. Insects. Simon Doherty is with the British Veterinary Association.
I think there's a really exciting future for the use of insects in pet food. There's a fantastic opportunity here to look at insects as providing an alternative source of some of the nutrient ingredients that we use in our pet food diets.
BBC reporter Roger Harabin visited a factory run by Protix, a Dutch company that manufactures insect flour for pet food. Here's what he saw.
They've got a tank about 1.5 times as big as an Olympic swimming pool full of black soldier flies. And that takes up about a third of the plant. There's still two-thirds of the plant left. And that is full of trolleys, full of wriggling, seething grubs.
Sure, that may not sound appetizing, but insects have their benefits. They require a fraction of the feed, water, and land needed to raise cattle or other livestock. Insect protein also solves an ethical problem, as one pet owner tells the BBC.
It appeals to me. Because I'm a vegan, I have to wrestle with the fact that I have to literally kill animals to feed my dog.
So there's a vision for the future. One day we might just be living in a dog-eat-bug world. Food is one way the Nordic band Sphere comes together. Jens Linnell, drummer for the group, says when the band gets ready to record a new album, they meet up to hang out, cook their meals together, then sit and play. And yes, beer is involved. A relaxed and homey atmosphere for the five members of Sphere is important because none of them live in the same city. Two live in Norway, the other three are scattered across Sweden. Every couple of years, when the group records new material, they live together like family. Sphere will be touring the U.S. next month. I suppose it will be one big family road trip. We'll let music from their latest album, Reverie, take us out today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a safe Labor Day weekend. We're back with you on Monday.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.